Welcome to another episode of We Have a Meeting. So today we have the privilege of hosting a true sales powerhouse. So with a career spanning across various industries from manufacturing to technology, today's guest is a master at building high-performing sales teams. But what sets him apart is that he doesn't just preach theories, he's a practitioner who knows what actually works in the real world. Author, founder, and all-round top guy, today's guest is Corey Bray. Corey, how are you?
Hey, doing great, Jack. Nice to see you.
Good stuff. Well, thank you for joining us. I know that you're a very busy man, so thank you for taking the time. We start our podcast the same way every single time. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Well, I'm Corey, and I was sent here to help make sales managers better coaches. And the reason that I'm doing that is that we built this consulting firm called Closed Loop, starting back in 2017. And over the course of working with hundreds of clients, tens of thousands of salespeople, thousands of managers, what we realized was that a lot of times managers are put into a position where they're not equipped for success. They're not trained in management. They're not trained in coaching. And it hurts them. It hurts their teams. It hurts their companies. And we're going to fix that. And that's what we're working on with Coach CRM.
And was there like a defining moment where it was like, you know what, I need to fix this problem. This is getting out of hand now. I know that I can do something to kind of be part of the equation.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of our engagements, what we do is we go in and do a bunch of things with sales teams that I don't need to get into. But one of the things would be we'd train managers on coaching. And we actually published a book in 2020 called The Five Secrets of a Sales Coach that outlines a framework that we had used for years as we trained management teams. And what would happen is we go and do the training, just like any training. Some people continue to do what they learn. Some people stop immediately. And leadership has to be able to understand what are people doing on the front lines and how can we help coach and hold people accountable to the application of the training after it's been rolled out. Well, when it comes to coaching, there's a few things that need to happen. A manager needs to diagnose and prioritize what to coach on. Then they need to coach. And then they need to drive mutual accountability with the person that's being coached. And with that, those steps, that ecosystem, if you've got a bunch of managers, how do you know what's going on? Well, The easiest old school way is everybody has a spreadsheet. And I remember one time, chief revenue officer walks up to me and says, "Hey, Corey, how do I know people are going to be doing this 6 months from now?" I said, "Well, Frank, everybody's got a spreadsheet. Here it is." He says, "I've seen the spreadsheet. I have 30 managers. What do you think I'm going to do? Look at 30 spreadsheets? And every spreadsheet has 8 tabs, 1 tab for each person on the team. Oh, and it's got columns for each week. That's untenable. So how do I know it's actually happening?" I was like, good question. I don't know. And at that point, I said, "Well, all the things I just described are problems that software is uniquely positioned to solve. So let's see if software is a good idea," and start working on some design, start talking to some buddies that invest in startups. And next thing you know, we've got software designs, 35 angel investors, and we're rocking and rolling, baby.
I love it. I love it. I love when you hear the story behind it. Okay. And if I lead a team of salespeople and so does Zach. So what symptoms would we have? If you're the doctor and you're going to come in with Coach CRM and say, "I'm going to give you a big prescription, lads, and it's going to solve all your problems." What symptoms will I see? Where will I feel the pain?
Well, I'll tell you the one that's a little counterintuitive that I go to all the time. Because, you know, a lot of times when people are buying software, they'll be like, "What's the ROI? What metrics am I going to impact?" I could say lots of things. I could say things like win rate goes up, deal size goes up, sales cycle goes down, number of products you sell goes up, renewal percentage goes up. I could say all of those things. And all of those things could be true depending on how it's applied. But when we think about sales teams, especially new business teams, when we look at the opportunities to make what's already been invested in actually work, that's one of the biggest opportunities for improvement. So for example, if a company rolled out a sales methodology, a lot of these companies are rolling out sales methodologies, and it might be something anywhere from a checklist-based, just a deal inspection framework like Medic, all the way over to something that's a more complete sales methodology like triangle selling. And what I ask them is I say, "Look, on a scale of 1 to 10, how well is your team executing on what you've already decided to invest in, already decided to roll out across the org?" And maybe there's different cohorts of folks that are higher or lower or whatever it is. And a lot of times folks say, our top people are doing well. Other folks just aren't using it. Okay, cool. So what are managers doing to drive progress towards the adoption an excellent usage mastery, whatever phrase you want to use, on a week-to-week basis? Well, I don't know. So that right there is the biggest opportunity for us. It's not about, let's go pick some metric and say that we're going to change the world. It's about, let's go look at these things that you decided to roll out and really failed to fortify, really failed to set up for success. Because if you've got a sales manager who didn't go to college for management training, they didn't do anything other than maybe go to a seminar or two, they get put into this role, and the only thing they know about management is what they've observed. They've got positive observations from folks that they've drawn inspiration from. They've got negative observations from people they say, hey, look, I never want to be like that person from a management perspective. That's what they've got. That's a very limited set. So what you've asked them to do is to create momentum and velocity into the future around this training. I'm just using this one example because I think it's one that's common to most teams, around the sales methodology. And you want it to not only be rolled out now, but you want it to work 3 months, 6 months, 12 months down the line. You want folks consistently setting great agendas at the top of the meetings, uncovering pain, managing resistance well. You want them doing demos that drive velocity in deals. You want them setting next steps. You want them creating momentum in between meetings. You want them to be able to land and expand. You want to be able to execute on all these things that the sales methodology will cover. But how do your managers understand, for each individual on my team right now, what's the biggest opportunity? And for each individual on my team, what else do I need to work with them on the future? How do I prioritize each one of those things? And when I get into a coaching conversation with them, which might be 3 minutes, might be 30 minutes, might be ad hoc, might be scheduled, how do I address that conversation in order to get maximum buy-in for them to change behavior, which may be adoption of additional skill set, it might be shift of mindset, it might just be an increase in activity. And then how do I ensure coming out of that conversation, as I've got all these other things, I'm coaching 7 other people on my team, I'm going to meetings with my boss, with my peers and all of this other stuff. How do I make sure that that's top of mind and it actually gets acted upon and I can hold accountability not only now, but 6 months down the road that we're not playing whack-a-mole with these symptoms popping back up and up and up over again. So that specifically is what we're trying to drive, is the great execution of the things that lead to those metrics, because you can't manage the metrics. And I think that's one of the things that I'm just passionate about, is like, you look at the great management thinkers of the last century, Peter Drucker, W. Edwards Deming. Well, Peter Drucker was somewhat misinterpreted around saying you can't manage what you don't measure. Okay, sure, whatever. That quote has just gotten blown out of proportion, because if you look at Deming says eliminate quotas and replace management with leadership and all these other things. In his later years, Drucker said, you know, Deming was right. What I said got blown out of proportion. It was wrong, but it's still just a thing that people say these days. So to summarize, the application of the sales methodology, the training, the skills that you've already rolled out, and making sure folks are doing those as best they can week in, week out, and getting better over time, that's what we're really trying to drive.
Nice to meet you, Corey. I didn't get to say hello before we jumped in.
Hey, Zach.
You alluded to something then. I don't want to make an assumption, but I'm guessing you've seen thousands of sales playbooks in lots and lots of different industries done in lots of different ways. Would that be fair?
Yeah, it's so fair that I wrote a book called Sales Playbooks, the Builder's Toolkit, to try to get people doing the right way.
Yeah, exactly. So based on that, what are the high-level lessons that we can learn that apply across any sector industry about what makes a good sales playbook and things that we should be implementing that maybe aren't as obvious as the stuff that you see every day?
Okay, so from a sales playbook perspective, start with this. It's a product. It is a product that you are building that people are going to use. And when you, the framework I love to use there is BJ Fogg, B.J.F.O.G.G.'s model. He's a Stanford professor. And to summarize, what he talks about is that the motivation needs to be incredibly high for anybody to do something that's difficult. And the motivation to learn that 12th customer story is not that high. The motivation to go reference this thing that I already think I know is not that high. So what we need is something that's incredibly easy to use, and so people don't have to be highly motivated to go do it. So what that means is that when it comes to sales playbooks, they need to be browsable, they need to be searchable, and it needs to be the content that a seller that's already ramped is going to need. A lot of folks make the mistake of, they put it in a PDF or a PowerPoint. There's one consulting firm that runs around selling $50,000 PowerPoint templates. It's just the most disgusting thing ever. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because it's just like, well, why are you giving those guys money? It's just silliness. And so you've got that situation. And then the other piece is make sure the folks that know how to sell your stuff, have something that's useful for them. And what that often looks like is it's discovery questions, asking different scenarios, competitive intel, updates on product stuff, responses to objections that are working for the rest of the team, maybe some things around demos and great demo flows or good questions asked during the demo. So there's all these things that target market personas that's not 101 basic training that could be referenced in pre-meeting prep, that can be pulled up live on the fly, and that can be coached after the fact. And if that's what the sales playbook's about, it's actually going to be useful. But if it's a static document that looks like 101 training, if it's process and procedures, it's going to be useful for the person that built it to go try to get a bonus at the end of the year and say, look at me, look at all the work I did, woohoo. And that's pretty much it.
And then if we can, just because you mentioned it, I'd be curious, but based on all the data that you've got, what's your favorite qualifying or disqualifying sales question that you've seen in those playbooks?
Well, my favorite qualifying or disqualifying sales question comes from a framework that we use called the Pain Finder. And let me walk you through what that looks like. And so it's going to be specific to each company. So the Pain Finder, you're going to look at, what are your features? And we're going to start with, what's the most impactful feature? We call it winning zone. What's the feature where you're most uniquely positioned to win? For each feature, what are all the benefits? And now people are listening to this, they're cringing. They're like, oh my God, CB's talking about features and benefit. Wait a second, chill with me. Hold on 1 second, folks. So we look at the feature, we say, what are all the benefits for each feature? And then we say, for each benefit, what pain would someone have to care about that benefit? So now we're translating the benefit into a pain statement. And then for each pain point, and it can't be cost, it can't be inefficiency, because everything costs something and everything's inefficient. So it's really about what's the actual root cause pain point that might require a little bit digging into to get to that root cause. And then for each one of those pain points, what market segment does it apply to? What persona does it apply to? And then two more questions, which is, what's the impact if we could solve that? I like to use a scale of 0 to 4. 0, no impact. 4, boom, changing the world. And then winning zone, how well are we positioned to win against the competition? 0, everybody has it. 4, only we have it. So now what I've done is I've taken what we do and I've created just what you asked me, which is, what are the most impactful qualification and disqualifying questions? Because now if I say, hey, look, here's high impact, high winning zone pain points that are relevant to this market segment and this persona, boom, that's what I'm going to cover in the first 10 minutes of discovery. I'm going to figure out if there's something here or not. And then if I do see that there's something here, if I do a demo or a presentation or scoping exercise, guess what I'm going to focus on? I'm going to focus on how we solve that. Throw that benefits column away. That was just a piece in the workflow. It's like showing your work in a math equation. And then that's what I do. No magic answers. It's all about using frameworks that help draw out the simplest way to execute well for the team. Because again, BJ Fogg's model, if you don't have high motivation, then people are just going to ask stupid open-ended questions like, so can you tell me about your process today? And if anybody's listening to this and their sales team starts a sales discovery conversation with, tell me about your process today, they're just hoping that the prospect says something that's going to land in their lap, because they've completely given up control of that conversation to the prospect. It's just crazy that people do that.
You make it sound so simple when we talk about pain and motivation, yet I know from training, from LinkedIn and things like that, that so many sales reps are just going out there and just focusing on pitch slapping and features and benefits. So that is the aim, to give people that are listening, SDRs, AEs, business owners, practical advice and takeaway. You wrote another book called, I'm going to try and get this right, 46 Reasons Why You're Fucking Up Cold Calls, to some effect, something like that. Is it 46?
Yeah, without the F word, but that's pretty without much it. Word. Yeah, I think it's 46 Reasons Your Cold Calls Fail and How to Fix Them Fast. It was actually, okay, I drew inspiration from that, from a book I read called Your Screenplay Sucks, because I'm a writer working on a movie script right now. Your Screenplay Sucks and 101 Ways to Fix It. So that was the motivation for that book.
I like it. What a problem, right, are they in order in the book? Or are they just like, here's 46 reasons, they're all as big as each other?
They're chunked together. So you've got things like market segments. So you're talking to the wrong target market. You're talking to the wrong personas. You don't understand how to position yourself against the competition. So there's fundamental market things like that. And then it goes all the way over to, how do you interact internally? Your handoff process is broken. Or you use the hook me up brother close, which would be like, hey, Zach, Wow, there's checks there. I'm looking at two people at the same time. So I say, hey, Jack, I want to get promoted and I need to hit my quota to get promoted. So can you just accept this meeting for me? Hook a brother up. And that's what they do.
Do they?
Oh, yeah, they use it all the time. That's where your, hey, venture capitalists, that's where your money's going, by the way. all these people talk trash on ping pongs and beer kegs. You should buy more ping pong tables and more beer kegs and less people that are cheating the system by trying to socially engineer folks to accept pipeline for them so they can get promoted to their next job where they're going to do other things. It's nuts. It's absolutely insanity. The ethics vacuum inside of some of these worlds. And here's what happens. Now you've got a manager that never got training on management. They never got formal training on ethics. I have. I'm to Wharton. We learned ethics. I passed CFA level 1 and 2. We learned ethics. Do you know the difference between somebody that has formal ethics training and how just terrified they are of doing stuff like that versus somebody that's just like, oh, well, I saw Susie do it last quarter, so I'm going to do it now. This is why that frontline management role is so hard, because the people are not set up for success. And that's one of the things that we're really trying to change.
Okay. So say I give you a team of 4 SDRs. They've just left university or college. Yep. If we're in the States. They've never picked up a phone. They've kind of never done anything to do with sales. You're going to start. You're going to give away your business for one day, and you're going to focus on coaching this team and leading this team. Where do you start? What do you do to get these SDRs in a position where they're not using closing lines like hook a brother up?
Well, the first thing they got to do is show that they can do the activity. If they're not willing to do cold calls and pick up the phone and talk to strangers and deal with rejection, then they should just go do something else. I think that's the biggest thing, because people think, man, I'll tell you, okay, now I'm going to go nuts. People tell me that's the hardest job in the company. It's not the hardest job in the company. It's literally the easiest job in the company. You know what your outcomes are going to be. You know that 4% of people are going to pick up the phone. You know 20% of the people that you talk to are going to take a meeting. You know that. It's literally math. It's like a machine in a manufacturing facility that has a known defect rate. Only you're a person and you're talking to other individuals. And along that journey, somebody's going to tell you something mean. And if you can't deal with that, then you should do something else. And if you can't deal with the fact that 50 people didn't pick up the phone until that one person did on the 51st try, then you should go do something else. Because that is the one thing that's going to separate people from being successful versus not. It doesn't matter if you academically understand the target market, the personas, the competition, the objections, all that type of stuff. Doesn't matter. If you don't have the resilience to actually be able to bounce back from somebody saying no or somebody saying F off. And then once you're doing the activity, because you can only control 2 things, you can only control the quality of your activity and the quantity of your activity. Well, maximize for quantity above a certain level of quality and you're going to see the results. That's what you've got to see. So in terms of ramping people up first day, get them on the freaking phones. And if you can't get them on the phones day one, get them on phones day two. And the only reason you can't get them on the phones day one is because they're doing their HR benefits paperwork.
So true. So one of the things that keeps coming up from people that we do training with is they're concerned that they're investing time in learning a sales skill set that might be taken off them by AI in the next few years. So yeah. As a man dealing with lots of different businesses involved in this industry day in, day out, what are your predictions on AI and the role of salespeople in the next 5 years?
I think when AI becomes, and I don't remember what it means, but AGI, I think it's artificial general intelligence, where it can actually learn and actually do human things. Once that happens, everybody's in trouble. But I don't think that's happening. It's definitely not happening now, and it's not going to happen in the next few years. Until then, there's just incremental changes in efficiency. So, okay, cool. The AI can help you write your emails better. We need fewer email writers. The AI can figure out who to dial and who not to dial. Cool, we need fewer people to do this phone work. Just like farming, there's fewer farmers than there used to be. But guess what? There's a heck of a lot more folks that do computer work. Just like call centers, there's going to be way fewer people in call centers. But there's lots of other jobs. I don't know what it's like where you guys live, but in the U.S., I think unemployment's like 3.5%. If you want a job, you can get a job. Plenty of jobs to go around. And the jobs will become different. They'll change. And maybe you need to retool yourself a little bit. But there's always going to be jobs. There's always going to be management jobs. And AI is so far away from being able to replace good management and good leadership, that I wouldn't worry about it taking your job. I would just worry about what can you do to build your skill set, both hard skills and soft skills. Because, yeah, hard skills, co-pilots to write basic code, sure, yeah, I can spin up a website, but it can't solve really hard problems that are undefined. And that's where people can come in and do the work. And from a sales perspective, you know, I think prospects are like prey. Once the prey learns the predator's tactics, the prey changes their tactics, and then they move on.
I saw something the other day where it might be on Lex Friedman's podcast or someone like that, where he was saying that it's very hard to teach AI common sense, which arguably a lot of human beings have and don't have, but
yeah.
Common sense on a sales conversation of someone saying something and you being able to realize that's a joke or that's not, or that's a colloquialism for the area that they're in, all that kind of stuff, that the common sense stuff's going to be really hard to teach. So yeah, interesting. And it sounds like from what you're saying, inefficiencies within teams will get drawn out. So people who are procrastinating will have not really any excuse to procrastinate anymore. It'll just have more sales activity, less manual nonsense in the background.
Yeah, more activity. And the only reason salespeople exist is because of information asymmetry. You don't need a salesperson for steak, because steaks have USDA prime. Cool, I know what that means. A filet mignon or a T-bone or whatever, I know what that means. It's all standardized. Well, products that have salespeople are not standardized. Maybe they are differentiated in ways out of the box that need to be explored. And so that information asymmetry comes in, where the prospect doesn't understand exactly what it is or how it's going to work or what it's going to fit, how it's going to fit into their ecosystem. They have questions, they have concerns, things like this. Salesperson shepherds them through that. If it was very clear, hey, this thing does these things for these people in these ways, and here's how much it costs, and that's a fair price, and here's the risks, and here's what we do to mitigate those, and all this type of stuff, then you're just buying it off the shelf at Walmart. So what happens is you drift towards kind of where we're at now, where a lot of companies do sell their products just off the shelf and they don't have a salesperson. But by the time you start asking questions like, okay, cool, so how does security work when we've got folks in 7 countries, including this one country that has these unique regulations, and we still need access to folks back in the US or whatever. Once you start getting a little more complex like that, that's where a salesperson comes in, because that is clearly information asymmetry, where the prospect and the salesperson know different things about the same topic, and they need to talk a little bit about it to get some overlap. But at the same time, like, do you really need to talk to an enterprise sales rep to buy Dropbox for your company when you've bought Dropbox at your last 3 companies and you know exactly what you need and exactly how it's going to work? No, just buy it off the shelf. So fewer salespeople for stuff like that, sure.
It's very, very interesting, and I think that the world will change and the order takers will be, and this is what, when I go into companies and I do training, it's a case of like, there's a reason you're all sat here, is because the company wants people to actually sell. If they were looking for companies to just sort out whether I could get a cheaper energy or cheaper insurance, they just automate it all. So you make some very valid points. Corey, I can tell that you're very passionate about leadership, and me and Zach both lead a team. I've never had any formal management training. I think I probably fall into the bracket of, I've seen good leaders, I've seen bad leaders, and I've taken the bits that I like. I'd probably put a lot of what I've learned down to kind of self taught, so like reading stuff like How to Influence and Influence People. I think there's some great tips in there. What are the big lessons? Like, if you had to give me a crash course now, and like, Jack and Zach, I'm gonna make sure that by the time this podcast is done, you're gonna be the best goddamn leaders in the UK. What would that crash course consist of?
All right, I'm gonna run through a few things. So I'm gonna start with this statement, right? There's nothing wrong with being self-taught, and people can be incredibly effective if they're self-taught. But if I'm a senior executive and I've got a team of folks who are all self-taught, who are all doing completely different things, how do I get those folks aligned and moving in the same direction? Mm. That is the biggest issue. And that floats down to when you say, oh, individual contributors can do different sales methodologies or have different tactics. Sure, whatever. That's fine. If they're selling, they're selling. But that's not really the case when you've got a manager that has 8 people on the team and each of the 8 people is operating in a completely different way. How do you coach that? And then if you've got frontline leaders that are self-taught and they figured out their style, how's that second line leader coach those frontline leaders on how to become better managers without any consistency, without any frameworks? It's really, really, really hard. And that's where you get stuck. But to answer your question, there's a few things. And one of the places I like to start is really understanding the person. Understand where they've been and understand where they're going. So where they've been, let's talk about coaching, for example. How were they coached in the past? They play sports, they play an instrument, they do some kind of activity where they were coached. And what was that style that those coaches used? And how did that person react to that? You know, was it a very direct type of coaching experience that motivated them to rapidly get faster, better? Or was it a very direct type of coaching that turned them off? And so understanding how they've been coached in the past, what impact that coaching had, and how they reacted to it, that can help develop your style to coach them as an individual human. See, this is where it gets complicated. So we do have to have different styles because people are different. Now, if we're coaching on different subject matter and styles, that's where it just starts getting nuts. So that's where we want to have some kind of consistency around what we're actually doing. So that's where they've been. And then the question is where they're going. So what are their professional goals? Salespeople. Some salespeople want to be big ticket enterprise sellers. Individual contributors make a ton of money. Some folks want to be in management. Some folks want to go to marketing. Some folks want to be entrepreneurs. Where are they going professionally? We need to know that because that's what's going to create this motivation. Going back to this BJ Fogg model, if they have high motivation for something, they're going to put more effort. There's going to be, they'll do things that are harder, that have more friction. And so if we know, hey, you want to be an entrepreneur, these are the skills that you need to be able to build. Here's how you're developing them in your role today. If as a leader, I can show them that, that's awesome. And then on the personal front, same thing. What do they want? Do they need a bunch of money to buy a house, private school, cars, elderly parents, whatever it is? Or are they just trying to chill and party and live in a shack? Whatever their personal lifestyle is, you don't need to know the gory details, but at least to an extent, understand what motivates them personally. So if we know where they've been, we know what motivates them professionally, we know what motivates them personally, then anything that we do from a leadership, management, and coaching perspective can be wrapped in the context of that and will actually matter to the person. And that's a tool that we can use to get more buy-in than we would if we just said, you know, do it because Stone Cold said so.
Well, because when we're managing, we do see people that prefer direct feedback, and that's the style that they like it in. But then you are right. It's like when you then get into a different situation, that style that they typically like when it might be feedback on cold calls, but when it's a different situation or a different dynamic, that same style isn't relevant. So it's a hard one to balance of what kind of manager should I be today, especially when you're talking about other people.
Yeah, for sure. And if you know that someone prefers direct feedback and you go beat around the bush and be all soft and fluffy, they're going to get annoyed. They're going to think you're wasting their time. But if they cry when you question them, well, first of all, they probably shouldn't work for you. But if they do and you can't do anything about that, then you know you've got to take a different approach than the super direct route.
That leads on nicely to the last question of the podcast. It's been great. I feel like we could probably talk to you all day about it. This could have gone anywhere. In terms of the missing ingredients in sales teams that come up time and time again, and you think, oh, there it is again, deja vu, I know what this is before we even get there. What are those missing ingredients that it's such an obvious fix, but it's just happening every single time?
Not setting next steps the prospect agrees on, not uncovering pain, not getting the right people involved in meetings, not disqualifying deals that are outside the target market or with the wrong personas or some other reason they should disqualify the deals, not understanding relevant customer stories, turning demos into presentations instead of conversations. Those are some of the big ones that come up.
Wow.
And it's not hard. Like, there's five things. And it's nuts to me that these companies hire these sales enablement folks that hire sales enablement teams. They've got like sales enablement all over the place. And their freaking salespeople don't set next steps at the end of the meeting. Like, why? I do not truly understand how you can have a sales enablement team and have a salesperson that same day that team exists not setting next steps in the meeting. And then not uncovering pain. And then in the CRM, run a report that says, hey, look, here's all the deals in the pipeline. Here's the next step for each deal. Is it in the future? Eh? Is it actual real next step the prospect agreed on? Eh? What discovery notes do we have? And how's that align with sales methodology? Is there at least a reason why this person, you know, what's the pain point that's going to drive this person to buy from me? Like, that is the simplest thing in the world. And if I was an internal sales enablement manager inside a company, I'd have all this fixed in like a day and a half. And it's not hard. It's just, it's truly not hard. And if anybody thinks it's hard, shoot me a note and I'll show you specifically. I'll give you reading assignments in my books of how it's not hard and how you can just go do it. All you got to do is get the right people in the room. And this is the challenge. There are people inside of every company that know all the subject matter. There are people like me and lots of other folks that have frameworks for each one of these specific things. And if you have the right framework and you have the right subject matter, literally none of this stuff is hard. It's so easy. And it's funny because I say this and then people are like, oh, you're discounting and undervaluing or whatever. I was like, no. It's actually not hard. And if you think it's hard, you're doing it wrong. And that's just kind of the bottom line. Like, look at Efren Reyes play pool. Yeah. Is that shot hard? Not if you know how to do it.
Yeah, so true. Yeah, exposure and reps and having a pro. Yeah, exactly. One of the things that you mentioned that was really interesting, and this seems to be a problem that comes up time and time again, is the knowing when to disqualify something. But it's almost like the root cause of that is the sales culture itself. Is it's easier to overinflate your pipeline when you have your reviews of what's going on with maybes that deep down you know are never going to happen, rather than just very clear yeses and nos. Because you're going to end up with a much smaller pipeline that's more reliable, but you might still feel like, oh, my boss is going to be breathing down my neck of what's next. It's like there's that maybe cushion that people are giving themselves. What's the solution for, I suppose, leadership to be able to weed that out of the culture? Have you thought of anything on that side of things?
Well, the solution is to keep the boss from breathing down your neck, because a lot of these cases, it's survival mode where their companies have backed into a number and they say, we need this number no matter what. Okay, cool. So you can get that number from two places: deals in pipeline or deals out of pipeline. Deals out of pipeline mean you got to go prospect and find new deals that come in. Pipeline kills all issues. And so if you're trying to squeeze a gallon of orange juice out of one orange, it ain't gonna work. And leadership asking about something hourly or daily instead of weekly and whatever other frequency, it's not gonna change anything. And so it's all about, what are the fundamentals that we're gonna execute on? How well are we doing executing against those fundamentals? So instead of going in there and be like, oh, hey, can we do something with this company to make this thing go faster? It's like, no, build a freaking time machine and go talk to the right people 3 weeks ago. This goes back to talking to the right stakeholders in the company. Well, you're only at this level. You need to be two levels higher. We're not there. And now you're trying to close this deal in the next week because we've got to hit some number for our quarterly goal because that's what we agreed to. Well, if management saw that coming faster and they were able to identify, well, this is not just a deal-specific issue. This is a human-specific issue where I need to coach this individual salesperson on one of these things, say next steps, I'm going to bring pain, getting to the right stakeholders, whatever it is, just a general application of skills or a shift in the mindset of what's important, what's not, and things like that, then it works. But leadership is not asking for updates on a deal because, first of all, that's what the CRM does. And so why are you also doing it? And then the big question is, did the person apply the sales methodology, what they've been trained on? They do it. Did they do it well? Did they do it well under pressure? And if the answer to any of those is no, then it's a coaching opportunity. And that's what, and look, yeah, if you got to close a deal this quarter, do it, whatever. But a lot of these companies that say, hey, oh, we got to do this because we got to get this deal in, they do that every quarter and they don't change and they don't get better and they don't look at themselves and say, wow, our management layer is broken and we haven't developed management skill sets to the point that we can run like a machine, as opposed to this company that's just constantly in crisis mode.
Brilliant. Corey, a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your insights with the audience. If anybody wants to check you out, work with Coach CRM, or where should they go?
CoachCRM.com, or you can check me out on LinkedIn, CoryBray.
Incredible. We'll include all the links. Thank you so much for coming on and being a guest, Corey. It's been brilliant.
Thanks, guys. Corey. Appreciate it.